Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Getting started a little late this week, but maybe you are too. Happy to have you here on this Monday-ish Tuesday here in the United States. It's a Monday-ish Tuesday because Monday was the 4th of July. Even though it wasn't the 4th of July, it was the 5th of July, but we treated it as the 4th of July. And we're very glad to have you with us. We've got 2 hours of open forum with two very, very fine guests. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Call from wherever you are, in whatever condition you are, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, you're welcome to call with your questions about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. Our first guest, Joe Heschmeyer, former friend of everybody here, now our coworker. Hi, Joe.
How are you doing?
Very well. How are you doing?
Doing great.
I've been dying to ask you a question. Can I start off with my own question?
Yeah, please. I think you just did, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to ask two then. Is that okay if I ask two?
You've just gotten through your second one. But yeah,
all right, I'll make it three.
We can do this a whole hour.
Can I ask three? Okay, Joe. I'm glad to know that you are as childish as I am. Okay, here's the deal. What is the deal? There's a cardinal got indicted?
Yeah.
What is that about?
Financial stuff? Yes. The Vatican finances are famously like hard to oversee, and you've got all sorts of like politics and egos and everything else, and you're dealing with people's tithe money and donations and all of that. So it's hard to know where the line of just like ordinary incompetence ends and like actual corruption begins. But I gotta be honest, I was really pleased to see that rank and status isn't preventing that indictment from going forward, because the kind of cynical view is that they were going to have some, you know, low level cleric or a layman, right, or something kind of the fall guy, and it doesn't seem like that's happening. You know, one of the things people said when Pope Francis was first elected was that this was kind of a mandate from the College of Cardinals to clean up the internal situation with the Curia, because he was kind of an outsider being brought in who he's not an obviously greedy guy. You know, he lives a pretty simple lifestyle. We're not worried about like Pope Francis ferreting away a bunch of money to like spend on a yacht. Yeah. So he's in a good position to really crack down. And I think it's exciting to we'll see what comes.
Yeah. You know, I really like the fact that, you know, recently he enjoyed some time with Cardinal Becciu, and people were like, what does this mean? What is the sign? You know, what is this? What is the Pope saying? It just seems like the Pope is being perfectly Christian and charitable. He's not excluding this cardinal from his life or anything. As a matter of fact, showing all the signs of charity, but tough as nails, man. If you committed a crime, and I don't know if the cardinal did. I'm not saying that I know that, but if there's evidence you committed a crime, we're going to indict you.
Well, and, you know, I like that you're saying that, and the fact that there is still a presumption of innocence. Like, we don't know what the situation is. You know, a lot of people were quick to kind of judge Cardinal Pell when he was being tried in Australia in civil court, and the case kind of fell apart against him. So it is possible, you know, like the thing I said about politics means that someone could have it in for the cardinal, but I will say it doesn't currently look good for him.
No,
for Becky. So
no, and I it does seem like the Pope is serious, and I feel like people often, well, on this program we'll get expressions of a kind of hopelessness, like these bishops are never going to take it seriously. It's all talk. The Pope's never going to take it seriously. But I mean, he's the first pope in, I don't know, you probably know, hundreds of years to remove a cardinal from and laicize a cardinal, send him, you know, all the way back to your level and mine, Joe, and then and then now the Vatican prosecuting a cardinal for financial crimes. It just seems like he is serious business.
Yeah, you know, it's nice. There's that you know, the famous expression, only Nixon could go to China.
Yeah.
Like, you need someone who's not going to be, you know, so Pope Francis.
That's a Klingon expression, by the way.
It is a famous Klingon expression. That Pope Francis is known for all of his talk about mercy, which actually situates him really well to be a guy enforcing the strict demands of justice as well, because you're not going to mistake that for him being just merciless. And he actually, so he toughened up canon law on things like abuse cases and the like. And in the letter that he, or the apostolic constitution that he wrote about that, he had, I thought, was a great kind of quotation that really hit what I think a lot of people's frustration is with the bishops in the modern era. He says, in the past, great damage was done by a failure to appreciate the close relationship existing in the church between the exercise of charity and recourse, where circumstances and justice so require, to disciplinary sanctions.
Right.
This manner of thinking, as we've learned from experience, risks leading to tolerating immoral conduct for which mere exhortations or suggestions are insufficient remedies. This situation often brings with it the danger that over time, such conduct may become entrenched, making correction more difficult, and in many cases creating scandal and confusion among the faithful. For this reason, it becomes necessary for bishops and superiors to inflict penalties. Negligence on the part of the bishop and resorting to the penal system is a sign that he has failed to carry out his duties honestly and faithfully. I think that is like a great stirring call to just like, look, mercy is not an excuse not to enforce the law. Mercy is not an excuse to let like evil go unpunished when it's just running rampant. And when you do that, it makes people think you don't take your job seriously. It makes people think that you don't take being a spiritual shepherd seriously. And it entrenches these cycles of sin in this really scandalous way. I thought that was just, I was really stirred by those words. It was just one of those kind of like right on moments to hear like, oh, he gets it. He sees the real danger here.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's letting this go forward. And I'll just say this one last thing and ask you for a response, and then we'll go right to callers because the lines are beginning to fill up. One line open now, 888-318-7884. The kind of pain of going through these financial scandals, and it is just going to be more pain. I mean, you almost have a sense of glee in some reporting. Oh, you know, the Catholics are up to it again. They're, you know, corrupt. It's to me actually getting to the root of things in a way that even, you know, parish, you know, safety programs or whatnot, all of which are fine and good. I'm not complaining about them, but they can't. And that is that, you know, this idea about money and clerical secrecy, they go hand in hand. And breaking through that is actually a very hopeful sign for the church. That's my view. What about you, Joe?
Yeah, I think, you know, the so-called envelope culture, the bishop in West Virginia who ran into some scandal with money, one of the things that kind of emerged is that it was not unusual to just give like a huge kind of honorarium for just like a bishop visiting another bishop's diocese. And this exchange of just these like huge kind of unaccounted for sums of money is something that a lot of people were quite reasonably scandalized by. Don't get me wrong. I'm not against like the taking of an honorarium if you give a talk or something like that. We do that at Catholic Answers, but we're not just like, give me an envelope of cash and I won't report it to anyone. You know, like that's a different kind of culture. So the end of the envelope culture, I think, is a really hopeful sign that like a kind of a wake up call that, hey, you may have thought this was normal because it was 30 years ago. This is not normal. And this needs to stop. Like I think it's really important in calling out all the little ways that, you know, just material things in the world can lead you away from the radical call of the gospel.
Right.
Like it's actually helpful, hopefully, for our shepherds to be like, oh yeah, like I'm called to something more than material comfort.
Amen, brother. I've been waiting for your response. I'm glad I got to talk with you about it. And if envelopes do start getting passed around at Catholic Answers, I would like to be part of that, however. I would like to be included. I'm just saying this in case anyone starts passing envelopes around. Let's go to Mitch in Wisconsin, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Mitch, go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer, our guest this hour. No, Mitch?
Hi.
Oh, hey, Mitch. Go ahead.
Hi. My question deals with for someone getting a dispensation from canonical form. So I have a brother who's engaged, and he doesn't really have any interest in the church, but he was baptized. And I know canon law says that, you know, unless he gets a dispensation, if he marries outside the church, his wedding would be invalid. And I don't want to have that conversation with him. I still really want to be able to go, but I know that he won't go through Catholic marriage prep, you know, which is normally a condition to get a dispensation. So I'm just wondering if it's possible at all to be able to get one without going through Catholic marriage prep and without probably promising to raise your kids Catholic as well.
That's a really good question. So to lay the foundation, I think you, it sounds like you already know all of this, but for listeners who don't, the first thing to realize is that you are baptized a Catholic, you are a Catholic. Like, this came up actually the last time I was on this show, someone was asking, like, what would it take to, like, leave the Catholic Church? And the answer is nothing. Like, you might not be a practicing Catholic, but from the perspective of canon law, from the perspective of God, like, you've been incorporated in the family. And that's going to be important because Catholics can only marry, like, in the church or with the church's permission, with a dispensation. Like, it, you know, there's a natural rite of marriage, but it gets more complicated when both parties are Catholic, even if they're not practicing, or even if actually even if one party is Catholic. So this does get pretty messy. Canon 1127 and on is where it talks about, like, the dispensations for what it's called a mixed marriage. So in this situation, is the fiance Catholic or no? Mitch?
Is it, Mitch, is the fiance Catholic? Wait, for some reason I can't get him on air. Okay, go ahead, Mitch. Sorry. I was pressing the air button and it wouldn't put you on air, but you're here. Go ahead.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I know she's baptized in one church or another. I'm not sure if it's Catholic Church. Probably not is my guess, but it could be.
Okay.
Actually, no. Now that I remember, it's not. She's baptized, but she's not a Catholic.
Okay. So my understanding is that the governing law here, and if you talk to, even talking to, like, the local parish, we'll get you some good insight, is that Canon 1127, Section 2, is going to be the governing law, which talks about if there are grave difficulties in the way of observing canonical form, the local ordinary of the Catholic party, in other words, your brother's bishop, has the right to dispense in individual cases. So would this marriage be in the same place that your brother lives? Otherwise, it gets even a little more complicated.
I know that his physical location is outside of my diocese. Mm-hmm. So I'm not entirely sure if it would be in the within the physical location of the diocese or a little bit outside of it.
Gotcha. Yeah, okay, so it could get a little trickier in this case if he lives in one diocese and is getting married in the other one, because he'd need permission from his bishop, and that bishop would have to notify the local bishop where the wedding's supposed to take place. That's just, like, a thing to know. It gets a little hairy in these kind of situations. But the bishop has the power to dispense, and then the Episcopal Conference kind of sets the norms. Now, in practice, I don't know what they would say in your brother's case. I don't know all the circumstances of it. And I don't know, it sounds like they may be in a situation where he's not even interested enough in kind of doing any of the work to even get the dispensation.
Essentially, I would be the one who would have to get everything in motion.
I see. That's a really good question. I don't know if a non-party to the marriage can make the application. I'm a little skeptical. It's not sounding good, to be totally honest with you, about any kind of dispensation being given there. Would the proposed marriage take place in a Protestant church or outside of a church context entirely?
It would be completely secular.
I see. Yeah, it doesn't sound like you're going to get a dispensation there. I could be mistaken, but that doesn't sound like the kind of case that a dispensation would be given for. Like, they're just, it doesn't sound like he's trying to do what we understand marriage to be. One of the things we understand marriage to be between baptized people is there's a sacramental aspect, that marriage is an image of Christ's love for the church, and that it's one of the means by which he dispenses his grace for the parties to help bring each other to heaven. And if that's not what either of them are wanting, then they're just kind of not wanting a marriage in the Christian sense, which makes it really difficult if they're calling what they're doing a marriage. I know that's a tough thing, and that it leads to a lot of really tough conversations. I've had to deal with some of that stuff myself. It seems like you might be kind of in a pickle here, unfortunately.
And sorry about that pickle, Mitch, but we're in a pickle too. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with our guest, Joe Heschmeyer, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Don't forget to check out the latest episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus. You can listen each week to the world's premier podcast on Catholic apologetics at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catholic Answers Focus, now available at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Want the latest pro-life news? Want it delivered? Sign up. It's free. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, your source for everything happening now in the fight to protect the sanctity of human life. New episodes delivered every week to your inbox. So if you really want to know,
sign up today.
Go to EWTN.com/pro-life today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Really happy to be back. Thanks for being here with us. And wherever you are in the world, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884 and get your question answered about the Catholic faith. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe is a very, very fine apologist, the writer of a whole bunch of books and a growing number of books as well, including Pope Peter, the subtitle of which is
Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis.
You got to be faster than that, man. You got to be faster.
I like to watch you hang a little.
This is no, you don't. That's not entertaining. Just fill in the blank, man.
Bad radio for everyone else is good radio for me.
No, it's funny to you, but it's not funny to anybody else. All right, let's go to Texas, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Joshua in Texas, thanks so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes, I would like to know, because I'm baptized and I've received First Communion through the Latin Catholic Church.
Okay.
But recently, my family has been attending a Maronite Catholic Church. Can I receive confirmation through the Maronite Catholic Church? Because I'm supposed to be receiving confirmation around this year, I believe.
That actually is an interesting question for a couple of reasons. One, are they doing confirmation in the Maronite Church? At your age? Because they often confirm much earlier.
I believe so. Because they said that at our parish, they said they have confirmation classes and marriage classes. Like RCIA, they've established the whole thing.
Okay. Well, there's an actual process by which you can transfer rites, which sounds like it might be the appropriate way. I know transferring rites is a little bit confusing, but it's in canon law. It begins at canon 111, where it explains kind of how you become part of a rite. And then in canon 112, after you've been baptized, like how you become enrolled in a different church. So if you've gotten remission from the Pope, if you've gotten married to someone, those under 14 years of age whose parents switch rites also go with as well. And then at that point, you have the choice to return to the Latin Church if you want. The mere fact of like receiving sacraments in another church, in a Maronite church, doesn't make you Maronite, even if you go there like every Sunday, or even if you go there most Sundays of the year. That's not how membership in the local church is determined. I think you'll want to double check to make sure, because there is a separate code for the Eastern churches. So for anything about sacramental validity, you always want to check with kind of both. And so if you talk to the pastor, I think that's honestly the best way. I don't want to tell you offhand, because there's often mistakes, especially with marriage, between Eastern Catholics and Latin Catholics, where like they won't check the appropriate boxes and kind of do things in the appropriate form. It's a lot easier for confirmation, but it would still be good to just say, hey, canonically, I am a Latin Catholic. And then either A, I would like to find out how to become Maronite, or B, I'd like to find out how I can be confirmed as a in the Maronite Church while still remaining a Latin Catholic. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Best of luck to you, Joshua. Thanks very much. And many blessings on your receiving the sacrament of confirmation. I'm going to go now to New Orleans, Louisiana, listening on EWTN. Donna in New Orleans, go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yes, Joe, I was wondering, twice over the past few days, I heard two priests use the word kerygma, and I'm not sure exactly what that word means, so I thought perhaps you could explain that to us.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Kerygma just means to proclaim or proclamation. And so it's just like, what's the basic Christian message? Like, sometimes the way people will describe it today is like, if someone asked you on an elevator, what's Christianity all about? Or what's the story of Christianity? The kerygma is just unpacking that basic story. You know, God created the world and it was good. Through the fall, corruption entered in. God responds to that corruption from original sin and from all of the subsequent sins in the incarnation and in the cross and in the resurrection and in that free offer of salvation. Like, being able to explain that basic story, you know, God made us and it is good, it's very good, but there is this brokenness and woundedness, and in response to that brokenness and woundedness, he enters in to heal us, to elevate our natures, and to unite us with him forever. That's the kerygma. Like, the idea is that you're explaining kind of the beating heart of Christianity. Like, what's all of this about? And so that's it in a nutshell.
Does that work for you?
Okay. Yes, sir. It certainly does. Appreciate it.
Donna, are you? Thank
you kindly.
Thank you very much. Are you a full lifetime in New Orleans?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you got an awesome accent. I don't know if you're supposed to say that or not, but we actually have a list of our favorite caller accents, and you might be going on the list.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
I love that.
Good list to be on.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you, sir.
All right, so that means you get to call back anytime too. So we'll let you on anytime, Donna. Thanks very much for the question.
Wow. There you go.
Now get out there and share the kerygma. We're going to.
Yes, sir. Kerygma.
Kerygma, yeah.
Kerygma, yes. I wasn't even going to catch you on that one. But
so now you're going to mess with my accent after all of that, Donna. Take Donna off the list. Off the list. Thank you, Donna.
Oh,
no, it was a great pleasure talking
Thank
with you. Thank
sir.
You. All right. Bye-bye. Let's go to New York. Not New York City, so I ain't going to do it. In New York, watching on YouTube. Austin, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. So in the Bible, it says God stopped creating on the seventh day. So my question is, how does an eternal being create and stop creating?
You're not giving me the easy questions, are you?
Wait a second. That is a killer question. Are you kidding me, Austin?
It's a great question because it's inside of time from our perspective. Like, when it says God rests, it doesn't mean literally he was in motion and then he stopped being in motion, something like that. Because you're right, that would introduce some kind of change in God. And so really, actually, we could maybe just take a moment here and say there are a lot of times in the Bible in which, in order to describe what's going on, you'll have this thing about, you know, God repented of having created humanity, and so he sent the flood. Or, you know, he turned back from his anger against people, that sort of thing. Where, taken at a literal level, it sounds like God's got moods and changes and all of that. But we know from Scripture and from philosophy as well that, like, no, God is eternal and unchanging. There's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that he is timeless and eternal. Change involves time. Another is he's all good. And so if you make a change, you're either changing for the better or the worse. If God's changing for the better, then he wasn't perfect. If he's changing for the worse, then he's not perfect. And so either way, like, the perfection of God and the eternity of God are contrary to this idea of God changing. That's in the inner life of God himself, which is why when we talk about, like, the Trinity, we talk about the Son being eternally begotten of the Father. He's not begotten in time. It isn't like there was a time the Son wasn't and then he was. And the early Christians really hammer out all of that. But there's also the world of time, which God creates, and he interacts with that world in various forms and at different times and places. That's not God moving around or God changing over time. That's from the perspective below. Like, from our perspective, God was acting in this special act of creation, and then he stops. But for God, that's all one eternal, timeless act. Almost, you know, there's not going to be a good way to describe this with an analogy, because we're dealing with an omnipotent, eternal, timeless being, and we just don't have any kind of close, handy analogy for that. But I almost want to say, like, an artist creating, like, a comic or something like that, where you've got frame to frame, there's a movement to it, but the artist himself stands outside and can observe the whole thing as a whole and can connect different parts, and you can see the connection between them. That's not a great analogy, but a little bit of what it's like, the difference between God's eternity and our time.
Austin, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for about the hardest question I've heard in a long time. Anyone else, if you're welcome to call if you have questions for Joe Heschmeyer about the relationship between time and eternity and how an eternal being can create time. And good luck to you getting an answer. Be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Enter promo code EARLY to save $30. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
When God looks at you, what does he see?
Reflect on that question, then call us tomorrow on Take 2 with Jerry and Debbie.
On most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having fun with Joe Heschmeyer, our guest this hour. Very, very fine apologist who is also, in addition to Pope Peter, the book that I mentioned earlier, written several other books, including one that you might want to get before too long, because this is the year of St. Joseph. And thank God and thank the Pope for that, that this is the year of St. Joseph. And he's got a very, very fine book on St. Joseph, the title of which is
A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times.
You did much better that time. A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. You can get it wherever there are good Catholic books being sold. Next, we're going to go to Cleveland. John in Cleveland, listening on EWTN. You are next. Go ahead, please, with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yes, I think people might say in response to my question, what? I never heard that, and I think that's the problem. The media doesn't provide any background for my question to be reminded about an outrageous situation during the 80s in which policy of the United States was to prop up and overthrow democratic governments in Central and Latin America and put in death squad regimes. One of them in El Salvador was trained by United States at Fort Benning, a certain battalion that murdered Oscar Romero, the Archbishop of El Salvador, because he spoke out against this policy of the United States and the CIA putting in these murderous death squad regimes that kill hundreds of thousands of people in Latin America and El Salvador. And I'm just wondering why there has been no outrage from the higher-ups. And this was a high official who was murdered because he untypically spoke out against this alliance of the United States and the CIA and support for death squad regimes that kill people and the rich elites and those companies who are allies of the American business interests that are served by this kind of repressive policies. Why was there silence then
from
all the
from,
way to
wait,
now?
Let me just get you real quick. Silence from... You mean other bishops from the Vatican? Who is it that you wanted to speak up on this?
Well, from the Pope. It's certainly not
from the
victims of this.
Oh, well.
Daniel Berrigan and Philip Berrigan and Gene Donovan and lower-level priests and nuns who were murdered by these U.S.-supported death squads and trained by the United States.
I gotcha.
Okay, let's unpack a little bit, if I may. Yeah, so... Romero was not just murdered, he was murdered during Mass. So it was pretty shocking.
And Saint Oscar Romero.
Yes, Saint Oscar Romero. So in terms of like what has the church had to say about it, I think that's actually the answer right there. Like, he was canonized, he's treated as a martyr. His funeral was one of the largest demonstrations. Father John Deere, a Jesuit priest, said that his funeral was like the largest demonstration in Salvadorian history. And maybe in the history of Latin America, something like 250,000 people came out to his funeral. And the Pope sent Cardinal Ernesto Correggio as like his delegate to give the eulogy. I mean, so it's not like the church just like hushed this up or didn't talk about it. This was something that, I mean, I remember as a kid hearing about this. They made a movie about it. And it may be that people have kind of forgotten about it now, 41 years later. But this was definitely a thing that I think scandalized and shocked a lot of people. The U.S. wasn't responsible for his death, but there was definitely criticisms about could we have done more to, crack down on, for instance, the guy who ordered his death was still allowed to enter the U.S. after that. And so, like, during the politics of the Cold War, we partnered with a lot of people who did some pretty ugly stuff in America. So there were a lot of political calculations. And there's some questions about what the American government knew at the time in terms of his involvement with the murder. But these days, like, the UN's concluded that he was. It was the head of the group called ARENA, one of the paramilitary groups. So, yeah, I think the fact that the U.S. trained somebody who then went and did a horrible thing, the church did speak out about it, both in America, in Latin America, and I think in the Vatican. And he's recognized as not just a servant of God, not just a blessed, but actually as a saint.
Very, very troubled times. And I'm sure much of the history still to come out, John. But thank you very much. A tremendous, horrific injustice. But my understanding is that Archbishop Romero killed even while elevating the chalice. Is that your understanding, Joe, or am I remembering?
That is my understanding, but I don't know if that's just from the movie or if that was literally the moment it happened.
Yeah.
But he gives, actually, you can find a translation of his final homily, and it's beautiful. It's very powerful. It's very moving. And you can find an audio of someone, I think, performing that in English on YouTube. So Oscar Romero's final homily would be well worth kind of the listen, where he really is speaking out against the anti-Christian kind of government of the day.
Thanks, John. I hope you feel that we gave that adequate air. I think we tried to, but you're always welcome to call back any other time. I'm going to go to Illinois, listening on the Covenant Radio. Nancy in Illinois, thank you so much for your call and for your question. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Sure. Good evening, gentlemen. My question is, there is a movie that I found in my local store called Roe v. Wade, and it's my understanding that it was just released within the past year, although it wasn't in any of our local movie theaters. But my question is, have you all seen it, first of all? Second of all, there are a lot of claims that it's the truth, and that there were a lot of lies that were told from the very beginning, and in the entire way through the evolution of the abortion industry. So do you all have any comments on that or any information about that?
Is this the one that Norma McCorvey gave right before she died, where she's very obviously sick?
Well, she's in the movie. There's a very brief clip of her at the very end.
I think I know the movie you're talking about. I think it's just called Roe v. Wade. I have not seen it. I've read some of the things about it. And I believe, if I'm guessing correctly, the part you're wanting to know about is where she basically says she wasn't as pro-life as she'd pretended for a lot of years and that she was doing it for the money. Is that right?
No, I think we're thinking of two different movies. The one I'm referring to is the doctor, Bernard, starts with an N. I can't think of his last name, but he was in on it. Yes, and he was in on it from the very beginning. And he had a friend named Larry Levine, and they were the ones who kind of orchestrated the whole thing. And it's spoken from the matter of the doctor being like a narrator, and he says that this is the true story. So, but it really outlines a lot of that the whole abortion industry is based on lies.
Well, there's
including the case with Norman McCorvey.
It's pretty hard to have an industry devoted to killing children that's not based on lies. But
yeah, I agree.
Joe, did you want to add anything?
Well, I'm not. There is a 2020 film, but I'm not sure that it's the one you're describing because that one is much more from like a pro-choice perspective. But Dr. Nathanson is in that one. So is the one that you're describing seemingly directed from someone who is pretty pro-choice?
No. It's really like Dr. Nathanson's like biography of what happened during that time when it all started.
Mm-hmm.
And at the conclusion of the movie, of course, is Dr. Nathanson is converted and is baptized in the church and, you know, becomes a very strong proponent of pro-life. He actually even puts out a movie himself that he stars in Silent Scream.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that looks really powerful. I haven't seen that yet, but it looks really powerful.
Yeah, upsetting and powerful, but in a way that many people need to be upset, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah.
Joe?
It's hard to. I don't know exactly which movie you're describing because there is a movie called Roe v. Wade. It was made in 2020, but it sounds like that sounds like the one you're seeing. It's not that one. It's a different one. So without knowing the name of the movie or the specifics of it, I can't really tell you how accurate it is. Now, I can say Dr. Bernard Nathanson had this incredibly powerful conversion. He was one of the co-founders of NARAL and eventually realized that what he was doing was wrong. And I think it's really beautiful that he sort of saw the light and then became a very strong pro-life activist. At one point, he was he ran the largest freestanding abortion clinic in the country. So this was a guy who was not peripheral to the abortion debate. He was right at the heart of it. Now, his conversion is nobody really questions that. Nobody really doubts that. The other major conversion that there's a lot more confusion and kind of controversy about is the conversion of Norma McCorvey herself. She was Jane Roe in Roe v. Wade. Like, Roe is a pseudonym for Norma McCorvey. And so she is at the heart of the case, pretty literally. And she eventually repented of that, said she became pro-life. But then, like, on her deathbed, said that she'd done some of that for money. And I think the reality is her abortion position was always kind of a complicated one, and she didn't fit neatly in either the pro-life or pro-choice camp. And both sides, unfortunately, and some of the political stuff, I think there's probably some guilt in both directions in terms of maybe using a woman who was kind of troubled and complicated in some ways. So I can't speak, unfortunately, to the particulars of the movie, but I know a little bit about the kind of the history that the movie is describing, if that helps.
And I'm going to leave it there. Nancy, I'll just let you know that all year this year, because we're expecting a major decision on the Roe versus Wade from the United States Supreme Court at some point, probably at the end of next term, around probably a year from now. We're expecting some kind of decision from them. And so we're also expecting here at Catholic Answers that a lot of the old arguments, a lot of the old language will be resurrected. And many things that have been debunked will be brought up again. But a young generation needs to hear how those have already been answered. So over at Catholic Answers Focus, you're going to be able to find, we've already got one up. I think we're doing one with you, Joe, in the near future. But we've got one up with Stephanie Gray Connors. And what we're doing mostly is just taking bits of media that are pro-choice and explaining how the euphemisms and the deceptive language are used in order to justify the killing of children. Because as a famous comedian once said, all murderers are liars by nature. And if you think about that, it's true. Nobody goes, I'm a murderer, I did it. So we got to cut through the euphemism and the lies in the course of the next year, and we'll pray to God for a good and just decision from the Supreme Court. But we don't know what's going to happen. We're going to do our very best to challenge the lies. You can find all of those episodes as they come at CatholicAnswersFocus.com. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The people who call More to Life are often hurting so much. I just want to reach through the radio and hug them. I want them to know how loved they are and how much God wants to fill their hearts with His healing grace and His deep desire to completely transform the life of anyone who's open to the movement of His Holy Spirit.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak. Tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. It's feeling like a Monday. I always like Mondays because we get to go back on the air, but it's a Tuesday, and that's especially good because we get Open Forum, get to hang out with our good friends, the apologists around here. Second hour, Tim Staples will be in to answer your questions. And this hour, we've got, at least for the rest of the hour, Joe Heschmeyer, Catholic Answers apologist Joe Heschmeyer. I love saying that, Joe. Catholic Answers apologist Joe
Heschmeyer. I love hearing that. It's great to... have that be the case, yeah.
Especially because we give away envelopes of money.
We need to start doing that,
Right. It's going to be a new policy, giving away envelopes of money. Our number is 888-318-7884. Let's go to Rockford, Illinois, watching on YouTube. Russ, you're up next. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Okay, Joe, here it comes. I'm a Lutheran from way back when, and... always have had the Lord's Prayer in our sermons, and I've noticed that the Catholic has dropped the last few lines, and I'm wondering why they have that. Why have they done that?
Let me give you a little bit of history.
The kingdom, the power, and the glory are yours. That's what he's referring to.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. Yes, we didn't drop it. Those were added. And they weren't strictly added by Protestants. So the history of it's really interesting. The original Lord's Prayer is the one that Catholics are familiar with. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our trespasses, or some versions have debts, as we forgive those who trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. That's the original end of it. You can find that in Matthew 6, 9 to 13, in Catholic versions and most modern Protestant versions as well. What makes it complicated is Christians would add a little prayer at the very end of that. And this is an extremely early tradition of adding a little prayer at the end, where they would just say, originally it was just, for yours is the power and the glory forever, or for thine is the power and glory forever. And we find evidence of that in the first century in a document called the Didache. In chapter 8 of that, it has the first account of the Our Father outside of Scripture itself. And it says, pray this 3 times a day. And it has that, and it ends with that line, for thine is the power and the glory forever. Now, eventually that becomes, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and glory forever. And later versions of Matthew's gospel actually included in the text. It's possible, it seems probable, that some later scribe had the same thought you did of like, oh, someone must have forgotten these words here because that's what people always prayed. And so Catholics, to acknowledge both that the original Our Father doesn't have those words and that this is still a 2,000-year-old tradition, just doesn't date quite back to Jesus, what we do is we pray the Our Father in Mass, and then there's a prayer the priest says, and then we say, for the kingdom, the power, and the glory are yours now and forever, which is just a modern English version of for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. So we do still acknowledge that prayer. We still include it. We just include it like a few seconds later as a way of showing that it's not actually part of the Lord's Prayer as given to us by Christ, but it is always associated with the Lord's Prayer from the first century onwards.
What do you think, Russ?
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. We're happy to answer your question. Will you become Catholic now?
Certainly do. You know, there are some bumps in the road for me, and my wife was a Catholic, now was a Catholic, and now she's back, and I'm another First Free Church in Rockford. And it's going to be a trial, but I'm listening every day. We're listening to you and watching you, and you're the greatest.
Oh, Russ, you're the greatest. Thanks. I'll tell you what. I'm going to give you a choice. We have a book on Peter as the Pope, and we have a book on Jesus. Which one would you like? I'll send you either one.
You know what? Our shelf is full of your books with Horn and all the rest, and we have the Catechism. We've got them all.
So you don't want me to send you a book?
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
Send a, all right, yes.
Which
one? We'll take
one. Peter or Jesus?
Which one?
Yep.
Harry, which one do you want? Peter or Jesus?
Peter or Jesus?
Peter. Yes, yes, beautiful.
Okay, Russ. We're going to send you
Pope. Well, hang on.
We're going to send you Pope Peter, Russ.
I saw the way you tried to stack the deck to get your book there. I knew
I
what you were doing there.
Literally cannot give my book away. Literally cannot. I was sure he was going to go for Jesus. He's Lutheran. The book is called Pope Peter, and he picked that. All right, Russ. Can you get him, Nathaniel? Can you get his address? All right, we're going to send him Pope Peter. You know what? Send him my book, too. Don't tell him. Just send it along. He's getting the Jesus book, too. Literally cannot give my book away, Joe.
You know, there was a scandal in the Protestant world about 10 years back where it turned out a megachurch pastor was buying 10,000 copies of his own book so that it would get on the like bestseller list.
Oh.
So, just, you know, there's something to think about.
Do you think I can buy my own book at my salary from Catholic Answers? I can't buy one copy of it, Joe. All right, Russ. Thanks. Really, what a nice man. It was very nice to talk to him. He chose the wrong book, but God bless him. Anonymous, you are up next. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. Yeah, go ahead.
Cool. All right. Okay, so a bit of a story. I'll try and be as short as possible. So basically, 3 years ago, my mother came home and said, the person who does the piano during our Mass said, this is my husband. That's wrong against Catholic teaching. At the time, I unfortunately, you know, didn't understand the importance of the altar and the Blessed Sacrament. Fast forward to today, you know, I now know it, and the person still part of our parish still does our piano during Mass. And I was wondering, okay, do I say something like, you know, well, first I need to confirm with my mother, hey, is this the person, you know, and after that, you know, because I have no idea if this guy's repented, you know, do I, you know, just submitting an anonymous tip to my pastor, you know, I mean, all that I can do and just pray for the person from there on, you know, like,
you want
to
know
my obligation.
What's your obligation? Okay, fair enough. Joe?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The easy thing is definitely pray for him. And then, yeah, try to find out in an appropriate way, try to find out more information about the situation so you don't accuse somebody of something that doesn't turn out to be true. In this case, your mother mentioned this to you. I think it's good to say, like, is this who you're talking about? What do you know about this? What's this story? But if it is true, it's a slightly complicated issue because of something like the music. There are plenty of places that will bring in non-Catholics, sometimes non-Christians, to perform music in the liturgy because they're just skilled musicians. And there's a difference of opinion about that. I understand that view of like wanting, you know, the greatest musicians. But I think the flip side to that is, you know, the music is still an integral part of the worship. And so you have someone who is basically a worship leader who is not living in accordance with the thing they're leading in worship. Like there's something not fitting about that. And I think in those situations, it is appropriate to go to the pastor and say, hey, this seems inappropriate. And then they can kind of take it from there. I think that is an appropriate thing to kind of call out. I think we're sometimes too lax on letting people living lifestyles contrary to Catholicism have these kind of places of some prominence in church worship.
Does that help you, Anonymous?
Yeah, it does, you know. So tomorrow I'm going to film and ask my mom, make sure the story's right, and also tell her, sorry, Mom, for not taking you serious a few years ago. And, because she was just worried about, hey, that guy's not supposed to be on the altar if he's in a state of grave sin. I'm not going to say mortal because I don't know how culpable, we don't know how culpable he is, you know.
Right. I think that this is going to be in many ways so divisive in many parishes, Joe, which have, I mean, we certainly don't want to be in a position of becoming, a judgmental church where, you know, you got to be perfect. That was anti-gospel to do that. But for example, I've noticed that in Catholic schools, there are situations where there are two male teachers and they're publicly married to one another. And the bishop will say, well, no, this is giving a false witness to the students. And we can't give that witness. You got to find a job somewhere else teaching. And there will be, you know, a fury, like a kind of a Vesuvius of fury in the parish and at the school because Catholics themselves don't believe what Jesus taught about marriage anymore.
You know, I think that's true. And I think there's honestly a certain blatant clericalism. You know, if the priest was openly living a lifestyle contrary to the gospel, people would be outraged. They would want the bishop to do something. But if it's a teacher or if it's someone in music ministry or if it's a prominent layperson in the parish, then it's sort of like, well, that's their own business. Like we don't take them seriously as part of the church. But if you go back and read, for instance, St. Paul's writings to the Corinthians, he's calling out sexual immorality among members of the church, having these kind of prominent places while living contrary to the gospel. So it's not a new problem. It's not a new situation. It may be worse these days, but it's nothing new. And the appropriate reaction isn't, well, let's water this down for fear of, like, offending people or hurting people. Now, I think we should know that because people aren't well-formed, that this could be a very painful kind of road. We had a similar situation with music ministry here in Kansas City, and there people were very divided on the issue. Yeah. But I think you still have to do the right thing.
I don't want to discourage Anonymous in any way, but all right. In a large percentage of similar cases, I would say don't be surprised. I don't know about this pastor, but the pastor already knows this.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't want to make any judgment calls about what the pastor knows and all of that, but it does seem difficult to have someone in your employ who's on the altar, who's that part of like what you do every week, and to be that ignorant of their personal life if they're openly introducing people as their husband.
Right, right. In church, you know, yeah. After Mass, yeah. Yeah, and the again, Joy, I just want to the problem here is not about that we want to judge everybody or boss everybody around. It's about there's a certain what we're trying to communicate in when we're at worship, when we're in a Catholic school, and that communication involves the truth about chastity as taught by Jesus Christ, and we don't mess with that, or we shouldn't be messing with it.
One of the distinctions that's helpful to make is there's a difference between like trying and failing, which all of us do, and like not trying to do what the church is calling us to.
Yeah, right, right. Or I mean, and it's happening in all areas too. You know, we have priests who want to bless people's suicides. You know, the crazy things like that. Where it's some, if you don't say no, then you become culpable for participating in things that are obviously contrary to what Christ taught. Whether it's cohabiting as, you know, Catholic school teachers or whether it's being married to someone of the same spouse or whatnot, we are responsible for sharing the truth about the gospel and doing it as parishes and schools. Joe Heschmeyer, you're a superstar. Congratulations on having your book given away today.
Hey, thanks. It was a lot of fun to spend this time with you.
It's always fun to spend time with you, Joe. Tim Staples coming up next. Your questions welcome. Stay on the line or give a call, 888-31-TRUTH.